This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's Western canon. You may have realized now that you are not hearing the mellifluous voice of our intrepid host, Claude Myron Guzer. This is Daniel, his equally intrepid co-host. We are both very intrepid people. And we actually have a pretty special episode set up for you guys here, because there's been a new addition to the Western canon. Claude and his wife have welcomed a brand new baby boy into the world this week. So, of course, as one might expect, he is not available to shoot the shit with a dumb guy online. But we did find someone who is. Everybody, welcome back to the show. If you listen to our agoraphobia episode, then this fellow is no stranger to you. And if you're a connoisseur of fine podcasts, he's also no stranger to you. On with us today is friend of the show, host of Wittenberg to Westphalia, The Wars of the Reformation, Mr. Ben Jacobs. Ben.
Hello, everybody. Yeah. Hey, Daniel. How's it going?
I'm very good. I'm pretty stoked because one, it's always great to talk to Ben.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, or I guess I should say talk to you. I'm addressing you. I'm not addressing the audience anymore. I'm done with that part. This is you and
screw
me.
Screw those guys.
But no, this is gonna be a lot of fun for me, especially because we're talking about something that's very, if you have, of course, listened to the Cannonball at all, then this has already come up and I've kind of already talked about it. But one of my kind of favorite historical hobby horses is the enormous topic that is the Reformation and Protestantism in general. And Ben here, as Ben understands the enormity of the topic, because, of course, his own podcast about the Wars of the Reformation, he very insightfully began it with the it was the fall of the Roman Empire. Is that
fall
right?
Of the Roman Empire? Yeah,
because it's really the only way to encompass the import and really actually get all the threads that are going on in it. So why are we going to be talking about it today? Well, as you may remember from the last kind of regular show we did where we wrapped up Don Quixote, Claude very morosely mentioned that we were going to be reading John Milton next, best known for his epic poem, Paradise Lost, which I guess we'll save talking about John Milton sort of biographically and Paradise Lost as a work for the episode where we actually, Claude and I, and I guess whoever else we might rope into it, actually talk about it. But today, since, Claude's off with the new baby and, the inmates are running the asylum, I'm in my Joker makeup right now. We live in a society. but I thought it would be cool to do a little bit of a backgrounder in the intellectual and theological currents that John Milton will be drawing on. And John Milton as an author is very, very closely associated with the Puritan movement. Right. And Puritans, it is absolutely one of those topics that everyone thinks they know what it's all about, and no one understands what it's actually about.
Right. This is one of those topics where whenever it comes up in conversation, I feel like I'm Morpheus. What if I told you what if I no told one you? Wore buckle hats?
Right, right. and I mean, even beyond the earth-shattering revelations about their sartorial choices, the reasons why some Protestants called themselves Puritans and what that entailed and what it led to is a really fascinating story. And so that's why I wanted to talk to Ben about it, because, of course, as our resident, I'm going to call you our resident Protestantism correspondent.
Sure.
Here at the Cannonball. And
which is ironic, but yes. OK,
I guess it's most mildly ironic. Well, yeah, because, of course, Ben, you're not a Protestant yourself.
No, I'm Jewish.
Yeah. So Ben's background is Jewish. My own background, I guess I could say from the top of the episode here, I was raised Protestant. I was raised in the Disciples of Christ denomination, which is not very well represented where I live now. I live in Alabama now, which is absolutely dominated by the Southern Baptist Convention. But the Disciples of Christ are more of a Midwestern thing. And they never taught me, Ben, they never taught me in Sunday school that the Disciples of Christ movement was an outgrowth of the hilarious Millerite, millenarian end of times cult movement of the 1840s. It was basically like they were one of the, like, the Millerite movement was this millenarian movement that swept the country in the 1840s, yeah, where everyone, like not everyone, but millions of people were convinced that this guy knew when the world was going to end and the end times, yeah, were upon us. And of course, when that didn't happen, the whole movement shattered into this bewildering array of denominations.
Right.
But anyway,
right,
one of those that had attained a kind of they got pretty mainline pretty quick. So my own, right, Protestant flavor was pretty mainline. It's not very out there.
I'd say that's a pretty standard story. My mom converted. My mom converted to Judaism, and from, mm-hmm, talking to her, like, she would bring up things like they'd talk to her about predestination in Sunday school, and they'd go, "But we don't really. I mean, we don't really believe in that."
Right. There's a lot of hedging. You know, there's like, yeah, well, here's the reasons why our church is called this. And here are the reasons why we're not really on that anymore. but honestly, I think the Puritan movement is one of the best examples of that, because,
oh, totally,
I mean, today the direct one of the most, you know, direct descendants of the Puritan church is the United Congregationalist Churches,
yeah,
I believe is the name of the denomination, which has a reputation for being among, I mean, if you know, one of the most kind of open-minded and ecumenically minded,
yeah,
Protestant denominations in America, which is the polar opposite of what we imagine when we imagine Puritans. So, yeah, I guess the place to start talking about it is like, what makes a Puritan? Like how does one become a Puritan in the English Reformation?
Well, Daniel, what if I told you that there was no set theology for Puritans?
Oh my God, I knew it. Nothing is ever easy, is it?
I mean, okay. To understand the Puritans, you sort of have to, what the name refers to is that it was a collection of people who shared a view that they wanted to purify the English church.
Yeah.
But what does that mean? What were they purifying it against?
Right. So, what was adulterating the church? Yeah.
And to really understand that, you sort of have to go back to the beginnings of Protestantism in Europe. And I will try and do this extremely quickly because
right,
my entire show started.
Rome fell.
So Rome fell. No, there are three main wellsprings of Protestantism in Europe, right? There's Luther, who was the guy who broke through. Mm-hmm. His brand of Protestantism was, let's say, middle of the road. He liked a lot of things about Catholic theology, but he had some things that he definitely wanted to change. Then there was King Henry VIII, who started the Anglican Church, who basically had no problems with Catholicism, but wanted to be Pope of, right, England, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
And wanted to be able to do all the king stuff that he wanted to do. And then on the far other extreme, and, you know, King Henry VIII had a ton of problems with Luther. He spent lots of time ranting at people about those dang Lutherans and having them burned.
Yes.
But far past Luther on this little fake continuum that I've constructed, there's Calvin, John Calvin, who was a French-born person who was influenced by Luther, but sort of took a lot of the things that Luther had suggested, picked up a lot of the other stuff that was in the water, and took it to a whole new level.
Yeah.
Got himself kicked out of France, settled in Geneva in Switzerland. He eventually took over the city, banned dancing, banned Christmas, ran it as a theological state until he was killed in a skirmish with one of the other Swiss cantons, and then it exploded into revolution.
Yeah. So you know, it was basically
so
like
that's
the,
Calvin.
You know, he's the dad in Footloose, but, you know, but yeah. Wrote voluminously and very influentially.
And there's so much to Calvin, but I think the thing that's most important to say for right now is that he is, of the three, by far the most influential. Mm. He never convinced any political party to adopt him, really, outside of some small states, but his followers spread all over Europe along the trade routes, and then they just kept sort of sloshing back and forth and moving into different countries. And this is particularly important in this conversation because they moved into Scotland. While Henry VIII was cracking down hardcore on Lutherans, of course, the Calvinists couldn't get anywhere. But the Calvinists went into Scotland, which was less politically centralized, let's say, and essentially took over.
Yeah,
I'm heavily simplifying, but started the Presbyterian movement.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of I think that's kind of a point to make that a lot of these these movements weren't necessarily I think it was especially the case in Scotland. It wasn't that the Calvinists were coming in and like kicking people out. It wasn't like they were going to church to church and booting out these people. It was they were basically converting the existing Episcopal structure, I guess. Well, I mean, a word like Episcopal. They're basically where the current sort of church structure, they were subverting and convincing them to come over to the Calvinist position.
Yeah. Right. And the technical terms get really important here because, and Calvin was, in addition to being very religious, he had a very political viewpoint because at the time, most people weren't separating out religion and politics. Mm-hmm. But of all the people who weren't separating out religion and politics, of the ones who didn't end up becoming cult leaders, essentially, Calvin was the most political. And he had this very, we might call it democratic or republican view about how society should be organized. And so when his followers, notably John Knox, moved into Scotland, they didn't go for the powerful people. They went for the common people, leaders of individual congregations, and went congregation by congregation. Of course, Scotland as a whole was heavily Catholic at the time. And so there is this period where most of the population was Calvinist. And there was this superstructure of bishops and archbishops and a king and the whole nobility who were still Catholic, and then some hill people in the Highlands who were Catholic.
Yeah.
And the country was heavily divided against itself, and there was sort of this church hierarchy that was floating on nothing. And so what Presbyterian means in this context is that they wanted the locus of power within this church structure to be at the presbyter or at the congregational level.
Yeah.
This all becomes very important. as bizarrely arcane as all this is.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, after the death of Henry VIII, the Calvinists started infiltrating England, especially since they had this nice base right to the north there. But in England, things took a different turn because there was now a very pro-Protestant people. You know, things went back and forth as the foibles of the English monarchy went, but there were very pro-Catholic people in charge of England, pro-Protestant people in charge of England. And so it became easier for Calvinists to come in and actually get places within the set church hierarchy.
Yeah.
And so there was this discussion in England as to, do we need to do away with the church hierarchy here? And once we have it, what are we going to do with it? And all things like that. And this keeps going all through the reign of Elizabeth. Of course, everything that's going on with Mary is its own thing.
It's all very important and dreadfully complicated and far outside the purview of this particular episode. But please go watch the network television hit show Reign for more information about Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yes.
Very accurate information, I might add. Not at all, just a soap opera.
But yeah, then there's this whole long reign of Elizabeth, and then James the First and Sixth, and all the stuff that was going on with them. And this is all actually very important to the story. But you know, all this time that this is going on, there's this growing groundswell of Calvinists in England, and the mainstream church wants to move in a more radically Protestant direction, but gradually debates rise up over time because it's not clear what singular, because now there's all these, there's Lutheranism and there's Calvinism, and it's not clear what is the more radical direction that people want to go in exactly. And there's pragmatic people who want to maintain the church structure, and then there's people who want to there's different kinds of pragmatists. There's people who are extremely radical religiously but want to maintain the church structure. And then there's people who are extremely radical in terms of wanting to completely get rid of the church structure, but in terms of their religious sentiments are fairly out there.
Right, like the actual content of their their theologies they're proposing are, you know, I think that's what's fascinating about this time, is that you can have, you know, there's this political argument going on, not just with the state powers, but also politically about what is the body of the church politically to be, you know, where, so yeah, you're right. You had these mix of like a theologically extremely conservative, but politically extremely radical type movements. And I think it's just fascinating, this foment, which again, like, I guess we haven't quite gotten to all the various fracturings and whatnot, but just, but listener, dear listener, there is a kaleidoscope of sects and competing schools of thought throughout all of this, to the extent that I feel bad even using a blanket term like Puritanism, but
yeah.
But I guess we're getting to why that's a useful term.
Yeah. Yeah. The one thing that they all shared that you could collectively say about the Puritans was that they wanted the church to reform in a different direction from where it had been, which, you know, by the end of Queen Elizabeth's reign, it was no longer the Catholicism in all but name church that Henry VIII had, but it was a fairly religiously conservative structure.
Yeah.
So then we come eventually to Charles I. And there's a lot of interesting things about Charles I. My favorite thing is that when he became king, he was 5 foot 4 inches tall, but he was only 4 foot 5 inches tall at the end of it.
Yes. Oh man. Yeah. That's, and you know what? And Ben, I love this. For those who don't get it, this is a reference to a marvelous Monty Python, or I guess not a sketch, but a parody song.
Boisterous song.
A boisterous parody song, which I think has contributed to, among those of us who have, you know, listened to Monty Python records, which, you know, what, billions of people, of course, kind of contributes to a misunderstanding of Oliver Cromwell, because this is a song about Oliver Cromwell, and they keep calling him a Puritan, which I don't think is really technically correct.
I mean, he was... Given the broadness of the term, you know.
That's true.
But, yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So, Charles I facts. You got him here.
Okay. That was really, I just wanted to set up that joke.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Ben.
But no.
It really takes me back to seventh grade. But continue.
I may or may not have convinced a friend to sing that with me at a poetry reading.
It's tremendous. Oh.
So, the execution of Charles I in the reign of Oliver Cromwell was sort of a watershed moment for Protestants, because for the Puritans, because, you know, they had it, they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything blew up in their face.
Right. Yeah. You finally got there, and it's, you know, the religious and political threads all came together with this kind of this overthrow of not only the the received regime of monarchy, which was overthrown in favor of a kind of incipient bourgeois democracy with parliamentarism, yeah. But also the, you know, you well, now you're the state power. Like, you can shape the church power, you know, right, with that state power. Yeah.
And so, I mean, things got bad almost immediately because Parliament was there and they wanted to do things their way. But it turns out that the army that they had just used to overthrow the king, and which was arguably one of the most powerful military forces in Europe at the time, was composed almost entirely of crazy fringe radicals,
right?
who they at the time called dissenters, which was just this kaleidoscope of different sects. You know, even people who were radical, even to the so-called Puritans.
Yeah.
Things like the Levelers and the Quakers and all sorts of
God bless the Levelers. So yes. my historical heroes, those Levelers.
Yes. And so, you know, the reign of Oliver Cromwell was sort of this, you know, it started out being, okay, now Parliament's going to rule.
Yeah.
But it very quickly became Oliver Cromwell saying, you know, going over to the army and talking to them and going back to Parliament and going, you know, I think you really should pay them.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's where Puritanism in all its glory kind of exploded.
Right. That was its kind of, that was its high water mark in terms of sort of political authority, I suppose. Yeah. But it was already, you know, it was already a kind of, this fragmentation. And I guess part of the, I guess how we can explain the fragmentation is that you kind of mentioned that, like, you know, these were all people wanting to purify the Anglican Church of its, you know, impure elements, we might say. But yeah, they couldn't exactly agree on what those elements, which ones were the ones to get rid of. And they all fell under the kind of this purview of, like, well, everyone agreed that they wanted to get rid of popery. You know, they wanted to purge the church of its elements, which are holdovers from Catholicism. But again, it's like, well, everyone disagrees on, you know, what's the baby and what's the bathwater. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, during Cromwell's reign, they were doing things like shutting down all the theaters, banning dancing and Christmas.
Yeah. And yeah.
So, you know, all of which was extraordinarily popular, I can assure you.
Right. You really endear yourself to the populace when you just prevent them from doing anything that they enjoy.
Yeah. Everybody gather around. Good news. No more drinking.
We're nope. Liberating you from merriment. Aren't you happy?
This is what God wants.
Yeah.
So somewhere along the way there, I guess it's just worth saying that one of the little fractions of the Puritans were the Brownists. Mm-hmm. And I am not going to even attempt to explain what the differences were between the Brownists and the other Puritans, because I don't understand it myself. But the Brownists were really not down with the rest of the Puritans. And so a bunch of them went and tried to live in the Netherlands for a while. This actually happened a lot earlier during the reign of Queen Mary.
Yeah. So it was before even the Civil War and Cromwell and all that stuff. And they went to the Netherlands because that was a kind of, that was actually where Calvinism had kind of attained true dominance among all the political actors as well. Like, that was basically a haven for Calvinist thinking at the time.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Although then they got there and it was another one of these, you know, you found what you wanted and it turns out that you don't actually want it, because they got there and everyone else was Calvinist except that they were running this, you know, the most important trade entrepot in Europe, and they really just didn't care what your religion was so long as your money was good.
Right. Yes.
And eventually the Brownists got involved in this crazy scheme to settle this place called New England. They eventually named it that.
But it was interesting, like, part of their motivation, like, not only to kind of, you know, well, part of their motivation was that the, you know, thanks to the colonial mindset, this was seen as empty land. It was a place where, because that was part of, and I guess this must have been part of what made the Brownists kind of persona non grata amongst all the other Calvinists, is that they had a pretty, or at least the factions who came to create the Plymouth colony that, you know, we know and love here in America for having invented belt buckle hats. But the idea was that they had a very sort of holistic vision of a community, of a church in the community, and a community that is a church.
Right.
Basically. So like there was like, here is empty. I'm using very extreme air quotes right now. Empty land for us to finally plant a pure new society that will not be sullied by the mistakes of the past, by all the popery that is still going on over in England. I think that's kind of a fascinating, like it was one of the, like, they're very conscientious about the fact that we are staking out a new kind of human society that is going to comport with the will of God.
Right.
No matter what you might think, you are going to comport with the will of God.
Yeah. All of which was, you know, very, very, you know, chapter and verse Calvin.
Yeah.
But, you know, the big new thing was setting it up in this virgin territory.
Yeah.
Quote unquote. Right. and yeah, so these are the Brownists are the mostly the separatists who the Puritans who ended up, like we said, founding the New England colonies. And of course, I just have to say that as soon as the dissenters started showing up, you know, that ruined things for everybody, because Roger Williams comes in and says, "Hey, it's not empty. There's Native Americans here. We should convert them too." And then they kicked him out.
Right. Roger, that is Roger, please. Yeah,
it's true. They're speaking a language. I translated. I wrote a dictionary. Get out of here. So, So, I mean, we're at 25 minutes.
I mean, like I said, we're freewheeling. You know, mean old Professor Goozer is off taking care of his, you know, squalling babe. So, you know, we're just chilling, man. I mean, that's I think, honestly, Ben, that's terrific rundown. And I think, like, I guess to kind of pick out a few things here and there that I think are very interesting about, you know, Puritanism and the kind of the broad movement. And it's because the thing is, like, John Milton was really tied in with these guys, but he also had some pretty unique views of his own. He was, like, John Milton himself was kind of he was among the political radicals of his day, because he was a committed Republican, little R Republican, in that he was very committed to the, you know, abolish the monarchy, you know, worldly power, like, you know, like you know, worldly great leaders are not necessary. Like, you know, we're all going to be a body politic together. And that, of course, ties in with this, you know, Puritan idea of the communal faith experience, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to talk about, my communal faith experience. One of the most fascinating things that I have learned about in reading about Puritans and Puritanism and the Massachusetts Bay Colony and all that stuff is the weird kind of two-tiered nature of church membership, which is, I'm going to try to explain it, and Ben, please jump in to correct me at any point. But the idea was that going back to Calvin, he had a very strict predestination theology. Like, basically his reasoning was, because God is all knowing, omniscient, omnipotent, he has known for all time, for all eternity, before there was ever a creation, whom among mankind would be saved and whom would be damned. It is only because of the grace of God and the will of God that any human being can ever even hope to achieve salvation. Which is something that he kind of took from Luther, sort of, but also he really made it his own.
Yeah.
The idea was that humankind is so depraved and so cut off from God because of sin that they could never have the idea to open their hearts up to Christ without God choosing to let them do that.
Luther kind of fudged it a little bit. He was like, you know, but I mean, if you ask and you really mean it.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
And Calvin's like, well, you're just putting it off. Why would you really mean it unless God made you want to mean it?
Right, exactly. And so this gets kind of awkward
because the full implications of predestination are fascinatingly horrible.
They're fascinatingly horrible, and it's also a little awkward when you have a community which is supposed to be unified in a communal church, but also I don't know who's going to make it and who's not. I don't know who I'm going to see in the New Jerusalem, or do I? Because they started developing these ideas of, well, what are some signifiers of God's grace? How can we know? Can we know? And that's its own whole argument. Can we know whether we are in God's grace or not? But the Brownists, I guess, or at least the Brownist sect that established itself in the New World with this kind of communal, and I do mean communal, like it was like everyone knew your business. Like you had to go to church. It was like they would beat you with sticks to get you to go and sit your ass in church. But they had this sort of two-tiered membership where you could be baptized, but not saved. Like baptism was merely like, okay, well, you can come in the door, but you're not saved. And it was supposed to be a kind of a communally monitored, like basically it was like, I don't know, like a cultural revolution struggle session kind of sort of group interrogation of your own spiritual journey as you participated in the church community, as you demonstrated your own, basically as you ticked off the boxes of what they're looking for a saved person. And also you were having an internal spiritual experience that somehow they would monitor also, which I'm not quite sure how that worked. Again, they're just looking for, I guess, the outward manifestations of your internal transformation. And after this gradual years long process, then you would explain to them as a kind of oral exams that you are fully converted and then be a full member of the church. Mm-hmm. And that's fascinating to me. And I guess the sociological implications of that, this kind of ultra in-group, out-group, even within a group that is also very in-group, out-group oriented, I just can't even imagine what kind of social pathologies emerge out of that. Well, I guess, we have American history. But I guess some of the
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Like I think that goes, that style, that thread in the Puritan tradition, I think goes a long way toward the current stereotypes we have of them as very dour, very controlling, and all that kind of stuff. But it was a little more like, it was a little more sophisticated than that though. Like there are a lot of Puritan myths, and Ben, I want you to bust them up. I want you to like come in here with your wrecking ball, bust up our preconceptions of like how one is Puritan, because I think that has a lot of bearing on what John Milton was kind of about, because Milton really was out there in a lot of ways that I think I'll talk about after Ben helpfully demolishes some of these stereotypes.
Well, I think, I should have actually written out all the myths in the notes.
I guess a little peek behind the curtain. We have on our notes that some very extensive and beautiful notes that Ben wrote out here. It has like top 10 Puritan myths ? And I guess I should say, I really shouldn't put you on the spot for something you put in the notes with a question mark. That's bad form. That's bad podcasting form.
No, I
did you dirty, Ben. I'm sorry.
That's fine. But I guess reacting to what you were just saying in the context of mythology, the sort of view of them drama is extremely dour and dancing is forbidden and all that stuff, which I have, you know, done my part to contribute to so far today.
Right.
I think it's fair to view them within their own context where, you know, Calvin was a rock star.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Puritans and the people who were following that theology, as sort of awful and dour as it might seem to us today, the wrapping of this sort of extremely, in some ways, very reductivist religious philosophy theology with this extremely radical political philosophy was extremely liberating and exciting at the time. You know, you didn't have to worry about whether you're going to get saved. You just were or you weren't.
Right.
And the important thing was to just structure our society in a way that's just going to, you know, empower the church, by which we mean the society, and lead that church collectively makes decisions, but then the church is under the moral guidance and spiritual leadership of the leaders of the church, who are themselves then selected by the congregation. So it's like, it's this whole like Iranian constitution.
I was actually about to say, this sounds so much like the mullahs in the Islamic Republic. That's astounding. Yeah.
It's check and balanced to the nth degree, such that by the time everyone's balanced against each other, the only person who has any power is John Calvin.
Right, right. but it was also like the kind of in that kind of, there was a communal encouragement of achievement among the members. So it was like there's dynamism to it that I think gets kind of lost in the stereotypes. Like there was a real like. Well, there's a lot of intellectual foment. Like there's a huge amount of writing pours out of these people.
Well, and a lot of that's survival bias because there was, let's say, a disproportionate membership in the Protestant churches amongst printers.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And, well, there you go.
Educated classes. And so, you know, a lot of these people were ideologically convinced, partly because they spent all their time reading this printed work. The Protestants did a very good job of using the new medium of the printing press, which then would influence the people who were doing the printing and receiving the printed copy.
Yeah.
But then, so the printers themselves end up being ideologically convinced. So what are they going to print?
Right, that's a very good point. Yeah. That's
and so the stuff that survives.
You got to always think about those means of production, my man.
Yeah. And so the stuff that survives to us from this era is fascinating. And I mean, Milton's a classy example, but, you know, I just remember sitting in English classes in high school with this teacher who was like, you know, 3 weeks away from retirement and at the beginning of the year. And he's like, so we're going to start at the beginning of American literature, and oh boy, are you guys in for a couple of weeks of sheer boredom?
Right. I mean, yeah, exactly. I remember reading Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God in high school and just being like my eyes glazing over. And the thing is, though, like I since then I've come to actually appreciate what makes it important and kind of like where it fits in with everything. But if there's one thing that the high school literature curriculum does not do a good job of, it's integrating why the hell I should be reading this into the instruction.
Yes. Yeah. And I did find all that stuff deeply fascinating, but, you know, very much from a historical interest standpoint. But, you know, it's the prose is interesting. In general, like there's so much energy in what they're saying. There's so much energy in the crap they're spouting.
Yeah. I mean, there really is. Like, it's kind of. I think that's what's interesting about sort of John Milton, kind of, because he was active in this intellectual kind of Puritan printing foment before he ever wrote Paradise Lost. That was kind of actually more toward the end of his career as a writer, because he was writing these tracts and these religious arguments, these republicanist arguments, and all this stuff. I guess one thing that I was going to mention that kind of, I think, sets Milton apart from our traditional vision of Puritans is that he wrote extensively about divorce and why it should be okay. yeah. Which is fascinating. And I guess there's a little bit of a sort of a biographical element to that because his like his wife, he got married and then his wife left him.
Yeah.
So, but thanks to the laws, he actually couldn't legally separate from her. So he was just kind of in limbo. And so then he was like, well, wait a minute. Yeah. I'm going to, this says here in the Bible that actually divorce is fine. And here's a big screen why.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's like in this kind of the, there's a lot of imagery. There's a lot of very energetic imagery going on in the Puritan sermon tradition that I think Milton absolutely was drawing on when he, and again, I guess this, we could save this more for like when we actually talk about Paradise Lost itself, but just kind of, just to sort of place Milton in the intellectual foment there.
Yeah. And I think that that's something I wanted to talk about, but I wasn't sure how.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So I'm glad we got a chance to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's our, you know, my strongest, you know, emotional connections to the Puritans are, you know, those readings from high school, which were very interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could appreciate a lot about them. They weren't, you know, bedside table reading by any stretch of the imagination,
right.
But there was certainly something there. And then I think for similar reasons, although I would say that these are sort of in a weird way bedside reading. The prints, the woodcut and the ink prints from that time period are just beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just this riot of energetic devils eating people and.
Well, and but I think you're right. Like this kind of like the. You're talking about people who were convinced that they were at the vanguard of a new kind of human life.
Yeah.
You know, like they were there, they were recovering. Like, though I guess actually the kind of the primitive church movement would be a little bit later. That's more of a Second Great Awakening thing. But I think also you see it some in the Puritanism where the idea is that they're recovering what God actually intended for man to do and be, and recovering how the sort of the first Christians were and lived.
Yeah.
As their model.
One of the groups that I end up comparing them to a lot in a lot of ways is actually like the communists.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, ironic given the philosophies on religion held by the communists, but it's this very reductivist intellectual tradition that thinks that they have the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they reinterpret everything from history to science to logic in the light of this one thought.
Yeah.
And then want to be the vanguard of rebuilding the world along the lines that are seem to be exculpated by this thought.
Right.
And a big part of the thought that they have had, although it's not in the case of the Calvinists, it's not necessarily articulated fully, but it definitely is in terms of the communists, is sort of a rejection of the corrupt, wealthy power structures that they're replacing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which leads to this, you know, the way that they would probably see themselves is this stripped down, stoic, you know, lean, mean, we don't need that frumery and froppery, you know, way of doing things, which then becomes an extraordinarily, it's easy to see that as extraordinarily dour, but they probably would have seen themselves, but like, you know,
well, I think they would have seen it
industrial chic or something like
that. Yeah, they would have seen it as evidence of their authentic life.
Yes.
Like it was evidence of the, like, no, we're actually getting our hands dirty in the business of being human, you know, not dissipating ourselves on the frippery. And it, but you're right. It does leave this kind of, just a very conflicted attitude toward wealth and prosperity in that you know, in the purpose of building a new society in the new world, it was necessary to work very hard to do that. And so this kind of like, you know, our prosperity, what we can wring out of this land, what we can build and what we can draw on it. You know, we all work very hard to create a prosperous society, and that will, you know, by your fruits, you shall know them. Like that's how we can show everyone that we are the way to go. And yet also, and don't show it off, like don't be flashy about it. So it's a very conflicted and very odd kind of moral sentiment that is one of those things that really infects this sort of at least the you know the sort of the mainstream white American,
yeah,
you know, thought to this day, where you have like you know billionaires making a big deal out of you know wearing jeans and driving a pickup truck or something, right. Like even though you're like, yeah, you could buy and sell my ass 1,000 times, like you're not salt of the earth, you dickhead. Like it's
well, and that, you know? That you know that pickup truck is self-heating,
right? Yeah,
electronically like, adjusting mink leather
yeah,
seats.
Yeah, it's an $80,000-$90,000 pickup truck, my man. Like that's not you know.
Are you kidding? They've you know Lex you know Mercedes-Benz is making pickup trucks now.
They've God, it's astounding.
$200,000 pickup
truck. Yeah, I love the fact there. That like the Mercedes, I forget the name of the thing, like what letter designation it is, but it's like it's their boxiest, most utilitarianly styled SUV is also the one yes. that's $150,000.
Yeah.
Oh. But yeah, so this kind of what I think is interesting is that, and also like these with the kind of the broader Puritan movement being one of stripping away, getting to the bedrock, getting to the you know the real reality, I guess, of you know what the church is and all that. It also lends itself to a certain kind of ecumenicism, which is a little counterintuitive, but it also it's like, look, if we can get everything down to the bare bones, then that's something we can all share. And I think that's where Milton is coming from with a lot of his stuff. Cause he, in his writing, he's much less a kind of, I guess in this Brownist tradition of Puritans, he's much more like he's against church hierarchies. He's against state hierarchies. And it's from a kind of standpoint that look, if we can all just be freed to examine the gospel, it's a bit in the kind of the Lutheran tradition again, like if we can all just be free to examine the gospel, freed of everything else, we'll all come to the same conclusions right. because it's the gospel.
Right. But,
so I think
how can there be more than one truth?
Right. Right. So like for all his kind of contentious arguings, you know, back and forth in these tracts that he wrote, I see Paradise Lost as a kind of stab at a truly ecumenical Christian epic poem
yeah.
because it kind of, it treats as its subject one of the points of orthodoxy that almost every single Christian tradition can adhere to, or at least not find an objection to. And that is that mankind was in a state of grace and that was destroyed by the temptation of Satan in the Garden of Eden, which leads to sin entering the world and the fall of man. Like that's, right. you know, you can be Southern Baptist, you can be Pentecostalist, you can be Catholic, you can be Ethiopian Orthodox, you can be right. Syrian Orthodox. You know, all these strains of Christianity do hold that story and that interpretation of that story very closely. And I think Milton chose that as the topic of his epic, not just because of its kind of thematic elements that he thought would be very interesting, but I think also because it's one that like, you know, well, that's every Christian can have this right. story. It's not a, and which is one thing that I think I'm going to try to do as the Cannonball reads through it is I'm going to look to see if he ever tries to work in any theological barbs. fuck you, Luther, but you know, we'll see.
That would be really interesting. Luther's actual influence, in England waned pretty rapidly once the Calvinists started setting up shop. It'd be interesting to know if there were any volleys being fired.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, point. I mean, you know me, Ben, I'm a messy bitch who lives for drama. So I'm on the lookout. I'm on the lookout in the text. Well, this has been terrific, man. This is really, it's eye opening. It's enlightening. I think we got a really good idea of the moment that John Milton and the tradition that John Milton is coming out of and working in. I guess, did you have any kind of like final thoughts or anything, or was there anything that didn't come up that you wanted to talk about? Or?
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to tie back to sort of what we were talking about at the beginning and just say that the mess that was Puritanism didn't just end after the Puritans sailed, or after 1688, when the horribly misnamed Bloodless Revolution in England happened.
Yeah, it was not very bloodless if you happen to be Irish, we'll just say.
Yeah, no, no. No. this firmament that the Puritans were caught, that they caused and that they were part of and that made them up continued to cause new sects to develop, and those sects also came to the United States. And you can basically tie this period, the Puritans, to, you know, you name a sect in the United States, and they probably had their start in some manner that was connected to back to the Puritans. In some way, shape, or form, you know, right down to even the Quakers, who were so radically different theologically from everyone else, they came from this time period. The explosion of theological boundaries that the Puritans represented gave them the space to open, you know, do what they were doing and get converts and then move to the United States. So, you know, the Quakers, the Baptists, the Methodists, you know, throw a dart at a board, unless they're Episcopalians or Presbyterians, who got their start earlier, you know, that you're talking about Puritans. And, you know, even the Episcopalians were heavily influenced by the Puritans.
So. Yeah, and I would say, well, you know, and of course the Puritan movement came out of Presbyterianism itself. So it's all,
right.
it's as I like to say, it's all a rich tapestry.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Like the Puritan tradition is, you know, it's alive in all of these intellectual descendants, even if it's not, you know, the belt buckle hats that no one ever wore and the, you know, bundling boards and hitting you with a stick to go to church and stuff. But, but that thread can be, you know, you can pull that thread all the way back to the unraveling sweater of American and British religious life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, as an outsider, I find all of this fascinating.
Yeah.
It's just really interesting to see the branching of these theological ideas. In Judaism, we sort of all just, we didn't kick anyone out.
Right. Like, yeah. There's like, you know, the rabbinic tradition, you know, like after into the Second Temple, and it's like, look, we're all, you know, we're not going to get super tied up in kicking anyone out because, well, we need each other.
There's not enough of us.
Right. You know, we can't really afford to be excommunicating many people.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. I kind of, I guess for I myself, like I feel like I come at it as a kind of insider outsider in that I was raised in a church, but I would never have called myself a believer, you know, in it even at the time. And, you know, and ever since in my adult life, I've never identified myself as a believer of any sort. But you're right that it's endlessly fascinating. It's incredibly important. If you're going to understand anything about history or culture, like you're going to have to understand the religious elements in any of this.
Totally. So,
and, but
especially in this time period, it's just, you can't get away from it.
Yeah. You're absolutely. You're going to get nowhere without grappling with it somehow.
And all this is super important in terms of understanding, like, the American Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, the ideas that were influencing, you know, the people who started the revolution and everything that happened with them, you know, they left, the people who lived in the United States left England during this time when Calvinists are running around talking about, you know, incipient republics and rule by the congregation and getting rid of kings
and the possibility of making a break with the old world, you know.
Yes.
Even the feasibility of that project. Yeah.
Right. And certainly the religious parts of this were definitely toned down over time in the New World, but that, you know, that basic thing that these people left England at a time of civil war when, you know, armies were marching around cutting off king's heads, that's to say that that's not influential is just naive.
Right, you know? Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's terrific. That puts a nice little bow on it, man. Like we can, I guess we can punch out here and, everybody listening, please check out, Wittenberg to Westphalia by Ben Jacobs, who has so graciously joined us here. I say this without a shred of, any kind of hedging or anything. It is easily one of the most impressive podcast projects that's ever come across my attention. Ben is just such a thorough researcher. He presents it all in such an enjoyable and digestible way. Like I honestly, like you're doing us all a favor by taking all of this in and really getting to the nut of it and explaining it all. And I just have to say as someone who starts almost every single history question someone asks me with, you know, a history of Uruk and Sumer, I appreciate your willingness to go deep when you started the project. But everyone, if you're a Cannonball listener, I think there is a very high chance that you would very much enjoy Wittenberg to Westphalia, hosted by Ben Jacobs. Ben, thank you so much for being on the Cannonball with us.
Well, thanks so much. That was very nice of you. And I, of course, I'm happy to be here.
Fantastic. And I guess everybody be on the lookout for the return of Claude after his paternity leave. And we'll dive into the actual text of Paradise Lost. And hopefully we'll keep up this excitement. Claude is, of course, he's not too excited, but that just means that there's more for me to be excited about, I guess. I don't know. We'll see. Anyway. Well, good night, Ben. And good night, everybody at home. We'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.